Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's so great about living in a city? Nearly 250 Americans already do make their homes in cities, yet many of us urban dwellers imagine life might be easier, cheaper, and cleaner somewhere else. Edward Glaser disagrees. He is Fred and Eleanor Glimp Professor of Economics at Harvard University and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He explores how modern cities work and what makes some work better than others in his new book, Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. Ed, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So there's this idea that whatever we human beings are able to do well, we do even better in a city.
I think that cities succeed and cities continue to be so important because they play to what is fundamentally our greatest asset as people, which is that we're a social species and we come out of the womb with this remarkable ability to learn from the people around us. Cities work off that ability to connect us with other human beings, and it's those connections that ultimately make us successful as people. And by having more people that we can learn from, that we can work with in cities, we, in some sense, ultimately become more human.
Were you surprised at all to find that physical proximity still matters so much in this era when technology allows us to communicate instantly with people thousands of miles away?
Exactly. I think that's one of the great puzzles that lie at the heart of the book, is that you might have logically thought, and many people did, that the ability to connect effortlessly over oceans and continents would have just led to a great spread of people further and further out into whatever spot of sylvan suburbia appeals to their biophilia. But that isn't what happened. It's not like we all, are moving to lower density areas. It's not that we're all moving to the woods. We just passed the halfway point where more than half of mankind became urban. And I think there's a fundamental reason for that. It's not that the new technologies and urbanization are just going along together and they're unrelated. They're connected, I believe, because what new technologies and globalization have done is they've increased the returns to being smart. They've increased the returns to new innovations because you can sell them on the other side of the world, because you can make them someplace that's cheaper. And by increasing the returns to being smart, these trends are actually helping cities because we actually get smart by being around other smart people. It's what's most basic to us. And it's this fact that we are actually we've entered an information age, we've entered into a world in which ideas are so important that's actually made cities more healthy and more successful than ever.
So if more than two-thirds of us in this country are already living in cities, it would seem like we recognize the advantages. And yet many people associate city life with negative things, crime and pollution. You found some of those beliefs are incomplete, if not entirely outdated.
I think that's absolutely right, and that many of them are based on a vision of cities that's no longer the case. And it's important to remember that cities have downsides and historically have had enormous downsides as well as advantages. You know, the same proximity that enables me to communicate an idea with you face-to-face and the sort of rich complexity of interpersonal connections, that proximity also enables me to infect you with some kind of a disease. And, if you're able to sell someone a newspaper, you're also able to rob them at close quarters. Cities require management, and they always have. Most importantly, they require clean water. And this was an enormous undertaking of local governments in the 19th century. Local governments spent more on water at the start of the 20th century than the federal government spent on anything except for the army and the post office. But the result of those investments was that, in fact, cities became much healthier. A boy born in New York City in 1900 could expect to live 7 years less than a boy born elsewhere in the country. Mm. Today, life expectancies in New York are 2 years longer than in the rest of the country. That far from being unhealthy, cities are actually appear at this point in time to be healthier. We don't entirely know why that is. I mean, among older people, it may have something to do with walking. It may have something to do with social connections. Among younger people, it's very clear the reasons why death rates are lower among the young. And one force is the fact that there are just a lot fewer motor vehicle accidents. Taking the subway after having a few drinks is just a lot less dangerous than driving drunk. And the second force is that there are significantly lower suicides in big cities. And I think that's sort of one of the puzzles, that why we think about cities as being full of social dysfunction. Well, along perhaps the most important way of expressing social dysfunction or psychological unease, cities are just people in cities are just much less prone to take their own lives.
And even petty crimes, things like pickpocketing, seem to have fallen by the wayside, at least in this country.
It is amazing how crime in cities has decreased over the last 30 years. This has been such a huge problem in urban America, in the New York where I grew up. But again, this required very large investments in policing and urban innovations. Right, one of the great things that cities are able to do is to create the solutions to their own problem. One of the stories I talk about in the book is the famous story of Jon Snow figuring out from the pattern of cholera in London what the cause of the disease was, figuring out that it came from an infected pump. The city was, in some sense, his laboratory. The city educated him and the world about disease. Well, cities also came up with innovations that helped crime, and I talk about some of those in the book about the rise of smarter ways of figuring out how to stop crime and how in places like New York and Boston those innovations occurred and helped to reduce the crime problems that once had been so severe in cities.
So is it easier to combat the problems that do occur even today with dense urbanization than it is to solve the problems of urban sprawl?
The key here is not to, not to just focus attention on one type of problem or the other. The key is to make whatever sensible investments in both areas are needed to make things better. But there's no question that building up is a substitute for building out. And that, in fact, if you think that sprawl has gone too far, that, in fact, eliminating those things which, stop cities from growing is one way to move against it. One of the things that one of the points that I try and make in the book is I'm not trying to move anyone who lives in a, likes their suburban ranch house. I'm not trying to move them into a city. I'm not a lifestyle coach. And my basic goal is to give people as, many options as they can for living in different areas. But I do have a big problem with those federal policies and some local policies as well that act as if the American dream can only mean living behind a white picket fence in the suburb. I have a problem with those policies that stack the deck against living in cities and push people out towards sprawl. And some of those are our massive subsidization of transportation, of highways and low-density areas. The stimulus package had twice as much in terms of per capita spending on infrastructure in low-density states than in high-density states. And part of it is things like our infatuation with subsidizing homeownership, with things like the mortgage interest deduction and the extreme transfers involved in Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Homeownership is a perfectly good thing. I'm a homeowner myself, and with lots of people it makes sense. But we don't need the federal government there trying to push everyone into homeownership. And one of the reasons against doing that is that it pushes people out of urban apartments into suburban homes. Of course, the other problem is it encourages people to accumulate as much debt as possible. And, it's helped create the enormous troubles that currently exist in the housing market.
So when you talk about moving up rather than spreading out, it is sort of a lifestyle change for people who have lived in, if not individual homes, who have lived in sort of low-slung apartment complexes. What makes it so much more economical from an environmental standpoint to build really tall buildings rather than spreading things out?
So there's a story that I tell in the book about a young Harvard graduate who went out for a walk in the woods in 1844, and he did some fishing. The fishing was good because there hadn't been much rain lately. And after he had caught the fish, he cooked a chowder with his friend, and the wind flicked the flames to the nearby grass, and a fire ensued, and the fire grew and grew and grew, and it took down at its height more than 300 acres of prime Concord woodland. This young man during his day was attacked as being an enemy of the environment. The Concord Freeman called him a flibberty gibbet, which I think was pretty damning in 1844. Today, of course, that young man is the secular saint of American environmentalism. That young man was Henry David Thoreau, who in his time, as far as I can tell, did more damage to the environment than anyone living in Boston. Now, there's a moral to this story, which still matters today, which is that we are a destructive species that tends to do a lot of harm to the areas that we're around. And that as a result, if you love nature, it often makes sense to stay away from it. In the book, I talk about the research that I've done together with the UCLA environmental economist Matthew Kahn that measures energy use, carbon emissions associated with big city living and suburbs. And there's no question, and this is a point that David Owen also made in his book Green Metropolis, that carbon emissions are much lower in big dense cities than in suburban areas. And this comes both from electricity usage, energy usage. The average single family detached house uses 88% more electricity than the average apartment. But it also comes from less driving. Even people who do take their cars around urban areas are just driving much shorter distances. Now, this, of course, should be, is one of the reasons why cities are green. And it's important, even if you haven't bought into fears of global warming, one of the reasons to root for cities is that it actually will make your gas prices lower in the decades ahead, right? The question of whether or not China and India build cities that look that are filled with skyscrapers, that are filled with people who are walking to work or taking the elevator to work, essentially, that will put much less strain on the energy resources of the world than if they build sprawling car-oriented areas.
So in many cities that have been around for a while, building skyscrapers means tearing down structures that have been there for centuries or at least decades. This is not so much a problem in the United States as it is in many parts of Europe. But talk about what we need to think about when we're deciding what deserves to be preserved and what we can afford to lose.
That's a great question. So I come at this with an absolute reverence for many of our older buildings. My father was an architectural historian, and I believe that, you know, our great historical architecture is as much an artistic treasure as anything hanging in the Louvre, and it deserves just as much protection. But that being said, not every anonymous glazed brick post-war building deserves to be, you know, protected for eternity. And cities, when they're successful, need to change, and they need new space to accommodate new people. If they don't build, they become boutique cities that are affordable only by the wealthy. Jane Jacobs, who was in many ways the greatest urbanist of the 20th century and whose ideas infused this book, got this one spectacularly wrong. She actually looked at old buildings and new buildings in New York, and she said, well, old buildings are cheap, new buildings are expensive, so we should go around protecting old buildings if we want to keep New York cheap. Well, that's not how supply and demand works. You actually need to build more supply if you're going to accommodate rising demand. And if you just look at Jacob's own home neighborhood of Greenwich Village, which was perfectly affordable in the 50s when she lived there as a middle-income couple, now townhouses are going for $5 million or more. What middle-income person can possibly afford that? And preservationism has helped make sure that Greenwich Village is so out of sight, because no one's been able to build more supply to accommodate that demand. And if you want to just, you know, see this in action, just compare the housing, the importance of supply in terms of making places affordable, and just compare the prices in places like Dallas or Houston and prices in places like Boston and New York, even in comparable suburban areas, that Texas has, you know, forever been very enthusiastic about allowing new building. And the upside of that is that it actually means that ordinary housing is affordable to lots of ordinary high quality housing is affordable to lots of ordinary people who would be priced out of, you know, other markets, which have basically shut down the construction sector.
Is sprawl not a factor in this too, though? The fact that the land surrounding the metropolitan areas of Dallas and Fort Worth is widely available and it's relatively inexpensive?
For sure, land is critical. But it's important to remember that the reason why land isn't available in many northern cities isn't that there isn't land there. It's that regulations have taken that land off market, right, that you have 1 or 2 acre minimum lot sizes. So a fact to remember is that Middlesex County, Massachusetts, where I live, which holds, you know, Harvard and MIT and is a very expensive area, has at this point in time less population density than Harris County, Texas, which holds Houston. Right. So, in fact, there's an abundance of land in these areas. It's just it's not available for building.
Yeah. Talk about real income. This is one place that Dallas really wins out among a lot of comparably sized cities.
Absolutely. So the if we think about the success of Texas, and you know, Texas, again, had an enormous population increase over the last decade. And clearly, while, you know, many East Coast urbanites like to disparage Texas's cities, these are remarkably successful places, and it makes more sense for people in Boston and New York to learn from Dallas than to go around disparaging it. Certainly, when I've looked at this, the rise of the Texas megacities is associated with both economic productivity, right? The fact that you've got a vibrant economy, and in Dallas, certainly a very diverse economy that actually brings together lots of smart people who learn from one another and do the things that cities are supposed to do. But it combines that productivity with just much more affordability. And that affordability means that real incomes in Dallas end up being quite high. And that's been a big push in terms of the growth of these, the growth of the Texas cities. But the low prices are fundamentally about the fact that there is building that actually meets demand. And that's that the growth of Texas would not be happening if there weren't, if the rules regarding building weren't as relatively elastic as they are.
Harvard economics professor Edward Glaser is my guest. His new book is called Triumph of the City: How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Edward Glaser. He's professor of economics at Harvard University and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. His new book is called Triumph of the City: How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. Join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Ed, I want to talk about this diversity of economy, which has certainly helped us here in North Texas. Let's talk about, let's compare Manhattan and Detroit. I was unaware that until the 1950s, New York City was actually the center of manufacturing in this country when it comes to the amount of things produced and the amount of revenue. Compare that, which has of course fallen off, the garment district is not busy in the way that it was then, to a city like Detroit, which has really imploded due to all the changes in the automotive manufacturing industry.
The great tragedy of Detroit is that it went from being one of the most innovative places on the planet 100 years ago. So if you think back to the Detroit of the early 20th century, there was an automotive entrepreneur seemingly on every street corner, one smart person learning from another, Henry Ford, David Dunbar Buick, the Fisher brothers, borrowing each other's ideas, supplying each other with inputs, parts, and with financing. Just a great innovative cluster, and doing the things that cities do best, right? Connecting smart people, small firms, and connecting them with the outside world as well. Now, the great tragedy of Detroit was the idea that Ford came up with was this ability to produce affordable cars for ordinary Americans, ordinary people throughout the world, and that was a terrific thing. But he did it by creating vast, vertically integrated factories that came to dominate the cityscape of Detroit. Instead of having small firms, skilled people, connections with the outside world, it became a city full of large factories that were walled off from the outside world and were filled with less educated workers. And it was a great thing that Ford created good, high-paying jobs for less educated Americans. But the downside of that is that when conditions changed, when transportation costs fell, when it was easy to move production to cheaper right-to-work states, or heck, for producers on the other side of the planet to produce cars more cheaply, Detroit didn't have a comeback strategy. It didn't have a way of moving around, or at least not one that was actually successful. And New York was able to come back despite having, this huge garment sector. As you said, it was the largest industrial cluster in the country, garment production in New York. And it was hammered by globalization and the drop in transportation costs more than the hammering that the auto industry took. But New York was able to come back, and it was able to come back because of its skill base and because of a culture of entrepreneurship, because of lots of, bright people who figured out new ways to make a buck and to actually make things work. And many of the best stories there are ones about cross-industry fertilization, about how a city with lots of different industries manages to come up with good ideas. So think about Michael Bloomberg himself, right, who is an IT entrepreneur, who's a guy who, is in some sense competing with the people of Silicon Valley. But he was able to compete with them in his industry because he actually knew something that they didn't. He knew something because he had worked on Wall Street, because he had run the trading floor at Salomon Brothers, and that enabled him to figure out what the traders at Merrill Lynch needed in a way that no one sitting in Palo Alto could have possibly done, and that made him productive. Now, the other tragedy of Detroit, of course, is what they did do to try and make the city come back, and it was a fundamental misunderstanding of what makes cities succeed. The Detroit strategy, and it was not Detroit's fault, the federal government was there handing out money for these things, was to build new structures, new buildings with things like urban renewal, and to build transportation infrastructure like the monorail. Now, none of this makes any sense in a declining city. The hallmark of declining cities is they already have plenty of structures and infrastructure relative to people. The last thing Detroit needed was a monorail to glide over essentially empty streets. The thing that brings cities back is, above all, education, right? The share of the population with college degrees as of 1970 does a great job in the older, colder parts of America in explaining which ones of these cities have been able to come back. And that's precisely because skills are part of the urban success formula, because they actually create people who are more successful entrepreneurs. And, in fact, working around skilled people tends to make you more productive. As the share of people in your metropolitan area with a college degree increases by 10%, your wages, even holding your skills constant, go up on average, of course, by about 8%.
So we know that Detroit today has a lot of empty real estate and a lot of crumbling neighborhoods. A lot of people are talking about the potential value of literally contracting the size of the city. You think that might not be a bad idea?
I think it might not. I think the important thing is that Detroit needs to stop, and I think it has moved towards this in recent years, but it's later than one would have hoped. Detroit needs to stop pursuing a will-o'-the-wisp of coming back to having 2 million people. I think that's unlikely to happen. And it's not really the job of either local or federal policy to make that happen, right? The goal of federal policy, or one goal of federal policy, is legitimately to help poor people. And certainly, I think we owe the children who are growing up in Detroit better schools, more education, more safety than they currently enjoy. But while we I think owe much to the people who are living in Detroit, we shouldn't have a national objective of trying to make more people live in that city. We don't have any people. We shouldn't have any policy that encourages people to live in the foothills of the Rockies, and we shouldn't have policies that actually favor one place over the other. Instead, we should make sure that we're investing in the children growing up there and taking the innovative steps that we need to take. And if you imagine that Detroit is going to continue losing people as it has in the last 10 years, then thinking about how to remake the physical landscape of the city to accommodate that also, I think, makes sense.
Another thing that's not going to happen, no one's going to move to Detroit because they love the weather in the winter, or very few people, I should say. Talk about the value. It's almost hard to calculate, but you have some calculations here. The value of mild winters.
Sure. So there's no variable that better predicts metropolitan area growth in the 20th century than January temperature. And this is part of the flip side of Detroit's decline, right? As transportation costs fell, America was freed up from clustering around the older cities that were, in fact, the heart of a great transportation network, right? Detroit was formed on the Straits, right? It's part of this Great Lakes system. It's every one of America's largest cities, 20 largest cities in 1900, was on a major waterway because, in fact, water just made things a lot cheaper to move. And as those transportation costs fell, people no longer had to live in areas that had a clear productive advantage, like access to the Great Lakes or proximity to coal mines. And they moved to places that people wanted to live. They moved to something that I call consumer cities, places like Los Angeles that had a benign climate. And then innovations like the air conditioner and like improvements in public health also made it possible to move to hotter areas and help the growth of Sunbelt cities. Of course, the rise of the Sun Belt isn't just about a preference for warmer Januaries, although certainly anyone suffering through the current winter that we had in Massachusetts has got to think seriously about moving someplace warmer. But it's also about a change in the legal and political environment. And whereas the southern states of 1930 seemed like they were very inhospitable places to new industry, the rise of things like right-to-work laws played a big role in expanding at least manufacturing in the Sun Belt. And work by Tom Holmes of the University of Minnesota shows very clearly that manufacturing grew much more. If you just compare two counties on different sides of a state border, grew a lot more in those states that actually had right-to-work states, which tended also to be warmer states, than in those states that didn't have right-to-work laws.
So clearly, we in the southern part of the United States benefit from warmer temperatures. We also benefit, at least in many parts of Texas, and you look to Houston for this in particular, from some would say a lack of really strong restrictions in terms of how things grow and how new businesses come in.
I think that's right. I mean, the relative lack of regulation is certainly an attractor for both businesses and people in Texas. And for people, the most important thing is the fact that these lack of regulations, and we've already talked about this, make housing cheaper, the fact that it's just easier to build, the fact that you don't have, as you do in some areas of California, 60-acre minimum lot sizes, right? I mean, there's no surprise that areas around San Francisco get enormously expensive if you're going to be that restrictive on building. But Houston and Texas more largely has a relatively free enterprise attitude, and that has certainly proven to be helpful in the area of providing affordable housing. There's a great irony in the fact that, highly progressive states like Massachusetts and California that talk constantly about providing, affordable housing for ordinary people do such a bad job of providing, middle-income and lower-middle-income Americans with cheap housing that, my own hometown recently celebrated the opening of one one single affordable housing unit, as if that would make any difference whatsoever to the overall housing price issue. Whereas, you know, Houston and Texas, not through any conscious affordability strategy, but just by unfettering the market, made it possible for ordinary Americans to afford housing.
So what kind of infrastructure investment and government policy does make sense in terms of encouraging cities to be affordable and livable and productive?
So there's a question of growing versus declining cities. And certainly I've earlier made the case that California, that Detroit doesn't need Detroit doesn't need anything on infrastructure, but growing cities certainly do. But there's a warning there on infrastructure, which is that in fact you can't build your way out of traffic congestion. You certainly do need some degree of road investments in growing areas. But in fact, work by two economists in the University of Toronto finds that as you build more highways, vehicle miles traveled increase roughly one for one with the number of highways built. So basically, you build more roads, you just get more drivers, which tells you that just building more roads in and of itself isn't a solution. You can't actually build your way out of traffic congestion. You actually have to change people's behavior in some way. And here's where the tools of an economist come in. We've known for decades, for centuries even perhaps, that if you basically give something away for free, you're going to, you know, have people demand too much of it. You're going to have long lines and stockouts. And that's basically how the Soviet Union used to handle groceries, right? They'd underprice and people would be waiting in lines forever. Well, that's how we handle our highways in this country too often, is we basically act as if the right to drive freely on every highway was snuck into the Bill of Rights, maybe after the Third Amendment. And as a result, we have the traffic equivalent of long lines and stockouts, which is you spend forever in your car trying to get somewhere because we're trying to give the thing away for free, but you end up paying for it in terms of lost time. So while infrastructure is important, I think coming up with smart policies like the congestion pricing that has made, you know, streets move effortlessly quickly in Singapore, one of the densest places on the planet, and has also improved traffic congestion in London. These sorts of smart policies also make sense to couple with infrastructure investment.
Edward Glaser is my guest. He's professor of economics at Harvard. His new book is called Triumph of the City: How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. If you'd like to join us this hour, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk, Edward, about gentrification, which is seen as a problem when a decaying urban area sort of builds back up again. Unfortunately, in many cases, people of working class or even middle income are unable to stay because things get too costly. How do we prevent that?
Again, this is basically about the need, why it's so important to build up and why it's important to allow new construction. The inevitable result of urban success when a city like San Francisco, for example, or Chicago manages to come back not just as a place of productivity, but also as a place of pleasure, as a place where people actually want to live, in part by controlling crime rates, in part by taking advantage of these, you know, traditional urban, you know, edge of having lots of entrepreneurs in the restaurant business and lots of people who can cover the fixed cost of symphonies, concert venues, museums. The inevitable result of that success is there's more demand for the housing in the area, and that's basically what gentrification is. It goes from an area in which it's cheap because nobody wants to live there to a place that becomes more expensive because people do want to be in that city because they value the proximity, the closeness to the jobs and the fun things that are going on in that city. Now, if rising demand collides with fixed supply, right? Economics 101 tells you that prices have to go up.
Right.
So the only thing in the long run that's going to, you know, make the problems associated with gentrification become easier is allowing the builders to actually deliver more housing in high-demand areas.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Nathan in Fort Worth. Hi, Nathan.
Hello. I suppose the question I wanted to ask had to do with your guest comments earlier about how adding lanes really just creates more traffic, so we can't build our way out of traffic congestion. And I've long wondered if really the only way that we're ever going to get, we Americans out of our cars and choose a different way to use transportation or choose a different way to build our cities, is extremely high gas prices really the only way that that's ever going to happen? I'd like to hear your guest thoughts on that.
You know, I mean, we should have gas taxes that are appropriate for the, you know, for whatever we think the social costs are of driving. Certainly, and I'm not an expert on, you know, environmental costs. I'm not making a specific case for that. I think the larger issue, though, in terms of the congestion, is you don't want to just have a broad-based gas tax that charges everyone for driving, whether or not they drive during peak hours or not, and whether or not they're driving in low-density areas or in high-density areas, because it affects everything equally. What you really want to do is you want to charge people for the congestion that they're causing by driving. I mean, I'm a driver. I drive into work. I got to be charged too. I got to charge people for the congestion in the place that they're doing it. So you actually need, you know, the way that Singapore works is that they have transponders in every car, and on every major urban thoroughfare, they charge those transponders as you're driving, and those charges change by time of day. Now, that's probably more intrusive than I would be comfortable with in the U.S., but you need something like that that actually charges people for the traffic they create.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go back to Fort Worth this time, speak with Jose. Hi, Jose.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thank you.
Excellent topic. I just was wondering how come we don't have a speed electric train going from here to San Antonio or from here to Austin. I understand that Southwest opposed to that, but I think we need electric public transportation, mass transit, high-speed transportation for our own electric cars. That's my comment.
Thanks for calling. And one thing that you really like is the idea of improving transportation between major cities.
I do. I think actually the connections between cities are very, very important. It's less clear. I mean, trains are a difficult form of moving people around. They tend to be enormously expensive, right? The Congressional Budget Office's estimates were that high-speed rail costs $50 million a mile to build, which is just incredibly expensive. And they're not the only option. I mean, I think that's sort of an important thing to remember, is that you can actually do great things with buses on dedicated lanes in terms of public transportation at a fraction of the cost than putting people on high-speed rail. So while I certainly hope that we continue to have technological innovation in this industry that actually makes, you know, electric transit more cost-effective and quicker, there's a need to also pay attention to the cost of this thing, and I think that's one of the reasons why many economists are driven towards, you know, smart bus innovations that make public transit available to people. You know, one of the things that's really important about cities and public transportation is that cities often get a bad rap for having lots of poor people living in them, and that's often seen as being a very bad thing about cities. One of the points that I make in this book is that urban poverty isn't such a bad thing.
Let me have you stop there, Ed. We need to take a break, and I want to make sure we get the whole point, so we'll stop for just a minute. Edward Glaser is my guest. He's professor of economics at Harvard and author of the new book Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. We'll be back in a minute. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Edward Glaser is my guest. He is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and professor of economics at Harvard University. His new book is called Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Ed, you started to tell us that you are not a fan of the plight of the urban poor, but you don't think that cities make people poor.
Exactly. Thanks for letting me get back to it. The point is that cities are full of poor people not because they make people poor, but because they attract poor people. And the most important reason that they do that is because they provide pathways out of poverty. They provide the ability to partner with people who have capital or education or ideas that then makes them more productive. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think cities offer a path out of the joblessness that particularly afflicts the less educated sectors of the American population, right? Less than 4 in 10 high school dropouts right now who are adults are employed. But there's another reason why cities attract poor people, which is public transportation, that actually the ability to get around without a car for every adult is a big urban asset. And one of the pieces of research that I discuss in the book is my work on public transportation in poverty that actually finds that when you put in a subway stop, when you put in a metro stop in an area, the area around it gets poorer. It's not that the subway stop is actually making anyone poor. It's not that the rail connection is actually impoverishing any person. How could that possibly happen? But what's happening is it's actually attracting the people who value that public transportation. That's actually something that's good about these areas, just as the fact that cities actually attract poor people is actually something to be, you know, applauded about cities.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Leslie in Dallas. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, how are you? I am, maybe they said I'm from Dallas, but I'm actually from New Orleans and came to Dallas after the hurricane. And while I'm listening to all, I mean, this is such an interesting discussion, but I have a big question. You know, with all these ideas and thoughts, New Orleans has been one of our greatest cities. It's failing. Why? And do you have any ideas for bringing it back?
Sure. So New Orleans, of course, reaches its height relative to the country in the decades before the Civil War. It starts declining after the loss in the Civil War. And then during the 20th century, its port, of course, gets hammered by containerization and the move away from large numbers of people being employed in its, once robust port sector. The question is, how in the world does New Orleans come back? And I think that, in some sense, it's a very similar. The answer that I'm going to give you is very similar to that of Detroit. That there's no top-down magic bullet for a place like New Orleans. That basically cities come back because of the people living in them, because of the skilled entrepreneurs in their areas. And New Orleans has, for a long time, had relatively low education levels. So the most important thing, I think, for the long run for Detroit to come back is to, you know, work on attracting and training smart people. I often say that's the best economic development strategy really anywhere, to attract and train smart people and then get out of their way. And in the case of Detroit, in the case of New Orleans, I think this is particularly about schools, about figuring out things that can make New Orleans school system better. And it's also about playing off of the city's wonderful attractions, right? I mean, the fact that it has this beautiful older architecture, the fact that it has such a vibrant jazz community. These are great amenities that are the anchors, potential anchors for New Orleans Renaissance, although it probably still will be a Renaissance that's much smaller than the population that New Orleans once had. One final point about New Orleans that I make in the book was that I thought it was a mistake for the U.S. government to think that it was vital that it invest hundreds of billions of dollars in infrastructure to bring all of Detroit's population back. I always thought that was a mistake, because that money, you know, you could give instead $500,000 to every family that was displaced from New Orleans, and it's hard not to think that they could have been better off as a result of that. They would have preferred that. And one piece of evidence that's come out since then, which sort of supports the idea that you didn't necessarily want to push everyone back into New Orleans, is that the children, and this is work of Bruce Sacerdote from Dartmouth, the children who left New Orleans after Katrina ended up doing better, ended up getting better test scores than the children who stayed. And actually, it seems to have actually helped at least the academic progress of many of the children to actually leave that city.
Would you apply different standards in a city like New Orleans when it comes to deciding what to raise and rebuild upon, given the important historic nature of a lot of the structures there?
I think that's right. I mean, in principle, you know, I'm an economist. I believe in cost-benefit analysis pretty much for everything. So mm-hmm. I think of it as having uniform standard. But there's no question that New Orleans has very valuable assets, and that's how I would think about it. I think that can be capitalized and can be part of helping that city become a magnet for skilled people who want to live in a really fun, beautiful place.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back on the phone this time to Eddie in Dallas. Hi, Eddie.
Hi. Two quick points I'd like the author to respond to, and I'll just get off and listen. First of all, my sense is that many people who have moved out to the outer suburbs and even rural areas have been much more successful. So they move out to these areas because they want to get away from all the bad things in the cities. But, of course, then they get there and they miss all the good things about the cities. So then they get special subsidies in the tax code and other places to subsidize so that they can start getting some of the good stuff from the cities that they not having the bad stuff. And as the electoral system changes, I see those kind of folks getting only even more influence. So, for instance, here in Texas, in our recent elections in the state legislature, the Tea Parties and the more rural conservatives gained a lot of power. And then secondly, I'm not sure that from a policy perspective, kind of an academic perspective, I understand a lot of what you're saying, but are you really dealing with the brass tacks politics of a lot of this stuff. For instance, I believe that a huge part of the plight of cities is just frankly due to race, and nobody wants to really talk about that, but that's the reality. So I'll sit up and listen.
Thanks for the call. What do you think, Ed?
Both of these are great comments. Unquestionably, race plays a huge issue in the history of American cities, and I try to do some justice to that, because it's obviously both, cities have been both places of opportunity and escape from, say, the Jim Crow South, and also places of terrible deprivation, places where horribly painful segregation has occurred, and some of my own work on this topic has actually documented the enormous cost that segregation has created for people growing up in more separated metropolitan areas. So I certainly agree with that quite strongly, that's important. I wanted to focus more on the policy side and the relationship to rural subsidies, because I think that's really important. And in some sense, and I want to just come back to that's in some sense the central message of the book. It's not that I'm actually telling people who live in rural areas that they need to move to cities, but I am saying that we need to stop subsidizing people who live in low-density areas. I'm arguing that, in fact, we need to stop these policies that, encourage people to, buy big homes in the suburbs by encouraging them to borrow more. I'm saying that we should be warier about subsidizing highways in low-density areas. And in some sense, I'm hoping that the Tea Party is going to be with me on this, because basically what I'm asking for is a decline in, government social engineering the population, which is basically what this stuff is that it's, the government playing, playing nanny state and trying to push a particular lifestyle, which happens to be sort of suburban low-density living, on the American population. And what I'm arguing is basically that people should be free to choose whether or not they live in cities or suburbs without a government that's trying to push them in one particular direction.
Is it your sense, or have you found in your research, Ed, that there is a point at which density becomes so intolerable for particular individuals that they feel like they have no choice but to move to the suburbs or to exurban areas?
There are certainly people who don't like it, and certainly many people shouldn't live in high density areas. But a lot of what people find intolerable about density is subject to can be fixed with better policy. So you think about a city like Mumbai, and I just think about a place like the Dharavi slum, which is one of the areas where I've described in the city, which is both a place of spectacular private entrepreneurship. You know, in one corner there's a guy making bras, and you feel like you're back in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. In another area, there are people who are sorting through old plastics and recycling them. And in another area, there's someone who's making beautiful little pots. Great private entrepreneurship. But, there are children defecating on the streets, which are, of course, not paved. There's, the water is problematic. There's a, there are disease problems. And, you can't help thinking that, boy, some low-density rural spot has got to be nicer than this in lots of ways. But that's a statement about the failure of India's government, which just hasn't kept pace with the enormous strength of its private entrepreneurial sector. And cities require, these things like the clean water provision, these things like dealing with the crime, the paving of streets, the cleaning of streets, these things require management. And with management, cities can become, as they have become in the U.S. and in the developed world, much more pleasant over the past 30 years. So I think for many people, they're carrying around an image of a city that no longer exists, at least in much of America, and the city is just much more pleasant, even with its density levels, than it once was.
Is it reasonable for governments to offer incentives to builders to put in really tall buildings, particularly for things like housing, or is it enough for government to just get out of the way?
I tend to believe the right strategy is just making it easier for the private sector to do it. I mean, I've rarely been a fan of thinking that the government is going to be great at figuring out what high-rise building is going to go where. And some of the most spectacular failures of high-rise building, which in some sense gave high-rise building a bad rap, were in the public housing projects, where it was clearly not suited for that particular purpose. It doesn't mean that high-rise buildings can't be great houses. I mean, I grew up in a high-rise building, and it was terrific. But the when the government tries to micromanage it, I think things don't tend to work out all that well.
Now, you grew up in a high-rise building. If I understand correctly, you now live in a suburban area. Is that?
I do, absolutely. I've gone from being relatively like David Owen in his book. I've gone from being a relatively low energy user to being a much higher energy user. So I know of what I'm not just some guy living in an urban apartment who's declaring that I actually know what suburban life is like, and it certainly has its advantages. But I think for me at least, coming into the fact that I come into the city each day to go to work and connect with people, and the fact that I can bring my children in, as I try to as often as possible, into the city for for art museums, for theater, for whatever I can. I think that's sort of at least makes my life at least more than half urban.
Do you feel like it's easier to safely raise your kids in a neighborhood of single family homes than in a high rise building?
The safety of cities has gotten a whole lot better from when I was a kid, and I wouldn't say that safety played a large role in our decision to move to the suburbs. For most Americans, schools, of course, are the big things that relates to kids, and that's one of the great tragedies of our urban areas, that we haven't been able to provide great schools in cities. And in some sense, the way to think about this is that cities succeed by having lots of competition innovation, and cities are able to have great restaurants because there are constantly new firms starting up and closing down. But we've turned that off in our school system. It's like we handed all the food over to a big food superintendent who would deliver government-provided food in local canteens. And I think unless we open up the competition in cities, unless we allow for more innovation and entrepreneurship with things like charter schools, it's unlikely that we're going to be able to really fix the urban school systems. And that is such a crucial thing for enabling cities to attract more parents and indeed for them to do a better job of caring for the children who are living in them.
What do cities need to do in order to assess whether or not they are appropriately evolving with regard to diversity of the economic base and of productivity?
Well, I think there's no one right answer to that, but you certainly do want to pay attention to whether or not, you know, your employment is being focused on one particular industrial sector. You need to be focused on whether or not your, you know, the wages in the city are doing reasonably well and whether or not prices are doing pretty well. And then what you want to mostly worry about, because this is the most important thing that governments can do to impact entrepreneurship, is whether or not you're, you know, doing all you can to make the city livable and attractive to smart entrepreneurial people, which also means making sure that you're allowing enough building, but it also means good parks, and it means good schools, and all those basic hard stuff that city governments need to do. And then you also have to figure out whether or not you're over-regulating entrepreneurship, and too many cities throughout the world have made it just very, very difficult to, you know, open a new business in the area, and that's also an important thing that cities can do something about.
You've given us the reason for the extreme growth of the Sun Belt. Do you think that in 50 years the streets of Houston and Dallas and Phoenix could look more like the streets of Chicago and Manhattan today?
I think it's quite possible. I think as you know. The Texas building industry are great pioneers in lots of ways, and one of the things I talk about in the book is the Woodlands, this, you know, highly innovative development outside of Houston that I found absolutely fascinating. If I'm right, and if I think the trend will continue so that there are, you know, at least a growing large number of people actually do want the excitement of a dense downtown, then I have no doubt that Texas builders were, and in fact indeed today are, on the forefront of actually making downtown developments that are actually, you know, exciting, tall, dense, full of mixed use, and are delivering products and exciting urban lifestyle that people want.
So if you couldn't live in Boston or New York, maybe Dallas would be your third choice.
I think Texas is great.
Edward Glaser is Fred and Eleanor Glimp Professor of Economics at Harvard University. He's also a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. His new book is called Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. Ed, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.